Do you have any questions? Yes.
Oh, well, I just the statement that in May of next year, Rahm has invited NATO and the G8 to Chicago.
Right.
That would be a good time to intimidate him and also raise the issue of why Chicago must reintroduce itself as the center of criminal activity by hosting global gangsters when they spend so much effort to get rid of this image of Al Capone.
You know,
maybe you're welcome back to Chicago for that event.
Oh, I think I'm going to come back for that event. That's for sure. I was the last G number I protested. It was the G20 in Pittsburgh. And it's hard to intimidate an organization that has the full force of the police state behind it. I mean, in Pittsburgh, they had 6,000 law enforcement or National Guard people there. And they were armed to the teeth. You know, they had their riot gear, they had their weapons, they had their club things. And they brought that sound weapon in. What's that called? A
summer cannon?
Something like that, whatever. And we were the first people that was ever used on in the United States. And that thing's not fun. It's not pleasant it's not just about sound, it's about it's molecular.
The frequency actually.
Yes.
Disturbs your body.
Yes. And you can't, there's no defense against it. The anarchists were like rolling behind big trash cans and stuff like that, but there's really no defense against it. But also at that time, I was there protesting. They put this big, tall steel barrier around the whole area where the G20 people were meeting. And I got tear gas there. I got shot at with rubber bullets. And I would tell those guys that, I ran once and I stopped and I turned around and said, why am I running? You know, and I turned around and I said, I'm a grandma. Why are you chasing me? You know, and I told them, if you shoot me with a rubber bullet and actually hit me, you better have a real bullet because I'm coming after you. You know, that's just unacceptable. And I talked to them. I said, you know what? This is so fascinating to me that you're a member of my class, but you're enforcing for those people up there. Those people behind that fence, they're meeting to figure out how to screw you as much as they're figuring out how to screw me. You know, and they're knocking kids off their bikes and beating them up. And I would go up to them. I said, are you going to actually like get paid overtime for this? Are you going to go buy Christmas presents for your children right after you beat up somebody else's child? You know, so I say that we only have two classes, a robber class and a robbed class. But there's really a police state class that's the enforcer class for the robber class. And we need them on our side, right? They come from us. We really need those people on our side. Unacceptable to shoot me with a rubber. It was a good thing they missed. I'd probably be in prison right now if they hit me.
Other question? Yes.
Cindy, at some point you were talking about the places you have to talk here in the Chicago area, mainly universities. And at the same time, in Providence, I heard that there's no hope here in this country. Now, if you link that with what's going on around the world with the youth people that are protesting the street, particularly in my home country, Chile, mm-hmm. where students have created a very national movement today to get all this reform, change of the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
So the young people here in this country, how do you think they are reacting to what's going on here today? And what do you think in terms of the future? It's a new generation that are probably going to be our leaders soon.
Well, that's a good question, and that's something I tell the young people, that, you know, they need to join us and become involved, because we're handing them a very screwed up world. And even though we're trying to make it better, you know, there's many of us out there making it better, you know, Obama, people always tell me, oh, Obama inherited a mess. Well, this country's a mess. You know, it's been a mess. It's been a mess since it started. It started off messy, you know, and nobody's done the things that need to do to clean it up for us. And so we really are handing the next generation a big fat mess. And the people in universities, they're feeling it, the pinch, the squeeze the most. Well, maybe not the most, but they're really, really feeling it. In California, state university tuition is going up 81%. California had a $25 billion deficit, shortfall. California goes to the federal government and says, we need a bailout. The government says, we don't have money. But they have money to bail out Goldman Sachs or bail out, you know, other Wall Street companies, but there's no money to bail out California, because if you bail out California, we could actually keep providing the essential services and wouldn't have to raise tuition 81%. So there is a movement on California campuses to resist that, and the longer it goes, the more organized and militant that the students are becoming. And I go and I tell the students, you know what, when every time your fees are raised, you're being asked to contribute more to the military-industrial complex. Every time your tuition is raised, you're paying more for war, you're paying more for torture, you're paying more for economic terrorism. This is what you're funding, because the more you have to pay, the less your government is giving to your education. My daughter just got she got her master's degree at a state school in California. She has $50,000 in loans. You know, and that's not that bad to get a master's degree. We have a friend who's getting her PhD. She's going to have $600,000 in loans. Yeah. You know, so here in the United States, education is not a right. It's a privilege for the wealthy, for the elite. So many... There's this situation created in the United States. People always ask me, how come there's not more students involved? Well, the students who actually are able to get to university, they have to work a couple jobs maybe. They have these loans, you know, pushing down on them. They have to work their jobs. They have to keep their studies up. And the people who go to school, who are members of the robber class or the oligarchy or whatever, they don't have to do that. But why are they going to go out and protest when they're benefiting from this stuff? Back in the 60s, there was this big student movement on campuses, especially in California. Education was free. State college, state university was free in California in the 60s. You know, they didn't have to worry about this impending doom of loans. And, you know, you have to work for your expenses and whatever. But it was a different situation back in those days. But I do see more and more students rejecting having to bear the burden of the cost of empire. But somebody needs to be there telling them why. Why is your tuition? Why does it keep going up every year? Why are there budget deficits in state governments? And blah, blah, blah. that we have to be there to tell them that. And I think that hopefully they're really, really starting to get it. And I do see really, I see signs of good activism happening around this issue. But it, then, of course, it needs to expand. You know, it needs to expand past that.
I was just going to say one of the reasons why people have this sense that youth are passive or this group is passive and so on is the media that you talked about. For example, how many in the room know that here in the city and across the country, there's a movement of protest against Wall Street?
Right there in the front of the Federal Reserve here in Chicago, right?
Right. So New York is not the only place that this is happening, but New York inspired others.
Speaking of, let me just do a quick commercial. Speaking of our own media, I do have a radio show called Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and I have interviewed President Chavez for it, and, you know, other great social justice and peace activists and people like that. And so, not now, but afterwards, if people want to sign up to get on my email list, that would be great. And I also have some of my first books here. This is the first book that I wrote called Not One More Mother's Child. And I brought some, and I still have like 15 left, and I don't want to carry them back to California. So I am offering them at half price, $5, and I will autograph those for you. Or you can pay me $10 full price. I just don't want to carry any back to California with me. So
what are some good sources of information, you know, that on the internet, or, you know, that where should we get our information so that we do get the full story?
And I wanted other people to say what they think are sites that they get good information from, too.
Twitter?
I do, like, know mostly about Colombia from a Venezuelan viewpoint. And when I talk to people of Venezuela, doesn't matter if it's President Chavez or, you know, the people on the street, they were feeling very sad about the division, because basically, you know, the only thing that divides Colombians and Venezuelans is that line, right? And then, of course, the political difficulties, like you said. Colombia is closely aligned with the United States, and I'm not sure, but I think the situation is a little bit better than it was when Uribe was president. But I just want to finish with really quickly about that. I know, too, that Colombia is the most dangerous place to be a labor organizer right now, that labor organizers are being murdered. And so I want to Father Roy Bourgeois from the School of America's Watch, the next delegation he takes to Colombia, I want to be on it, because I want to go down there. I want to see exactly for myself what is happening down there. And I just hope, again, like with the people of Venezuela, that relations normalize and that Colombia joins the people's struggle in Latin America to make things better for the people, not for the oligarchy, and not the political.
I just wanted to tell you that during the 8 years of President Uribe, 400 million people were displaced from the land, mostly Afro-Colombian and indigenous people, just to give way to multinational corporations to come in. And that's what, you know, USA was, this kind of democracy was what, you know, USA was supporting.
Now tell me, Uribe is not president anymore. No, are not things getting...
His vice president is...
So things aren't... The relations between Venezuela and Colombia aren't getting any better?
I think the relationship is better. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing that the new Colombian president did, went to try to make peace. And I think the message that he is giving is that he is not as arrogant as Uribe, That's the only thing that I can take out of that. But the displacement continues, poverty continues the same, violence continues the same. During his presidency, there's still 51 union leaders has been killed since Santos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, still more indigenous and Afro-Colombians. During this year, around 30 Afro-Colombian leaders has been killed just because they're trying to get back their land. And this is the democracy that even President Obama is trying to support.
Yeah.
Right now he's pushing very hard a free trade agreement with Colombia. And Colombia just received a qualification as a human rights
approval.
Oh my goodness.
And it's like,
that's disgusting.
You know, what information are they reading? It's just very sad.
Can I?
I can give you statistics.
I want you to, but also I want to like make sure I understood what you just said. 400 million people were displaced?
No,
4 million.
Oh, 4 million. Oh, I thought you said 400. I didn't even know there was that many people there. Okay, that's 4 million. Okay.
I mean, it has more displaced people than Sudan.
See, that's not anything that I even knew.
And 90% of that displacement goes to Venezuela.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Colombians in Venezuela.
And Ecuador.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ecuador recently, yeah. Too.
But, you know, when I was Sunday talking about this, and there was a Colombian in the audience, and he got totally upset and walked out. Of course, because it's the same thing here. President Santos is the one who owns the media,
mm-hmm.
and most of the Colombian people don't know. Or they don't want to know.
They don't want to know. Yeah. I would love for the statistics. Did you? You're Colombian too, right?
I'm Colombian.
Yeah, and you were going to say something.
Well, when you said things are improving for multinationals and.
Same way here. Same thing in the United States.
There is something. Santos says he was going to try to emulate the ex-president of Brazil by reducing poverty. And they invented a really good formula. So right now, if you make more than $79 a month in Colombia, you're not considered.
Oh, yeah, they increased that. It's terrible.
That's what we do here in the United States, too.
That would reduce the poverty line. And as of last month, Colombia has been the number one country with the mining demand in the world. So there is no other country in the world that has more mining demand than Colombia is. Now, with the FTA, there is a very good thing. It is up online. You can read it. Articles 152 to 158 explain exactly what we can export. And there is no vegetables. There is no rice. There is absolutely nothing that would import. Now, they created this law called La Restitución de Tierras, so they're going to restitute the land to the ones that were displaced. But there was a law that was passed last week, which is the predial, impuesto predial, sorry.
Property tax.
So the land tax, but it's going to be the land that doesn't produce anything for 6 months would get taxed, I guess, all the time that it didn't produce anything. So a farmer that's going to be handed land that they didn't have for 7 years, he's going to get charged all those taxes, and he's going to have to sell it to the multinationals.
Oh, my God.
So the good thing is that things have changed in a tone because Santos is really, really good on knowing how to manipulate the laws towards the benefit. I remember that he was on the Wall Street Journal first page after he got to be president, and it says, now Colombia has a new change of tone.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about this, this is what every Wall Street person in the Financial Times sees. Why is Colombia so important? We remember 7 U.S. military bases that
mm-hmm.
wanted to be put right next to it, and
mm-hmm.
that's why Hugo Chavez, you know, he knows what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we all remember, we used to be La Gran Colombia, that's why we shared the same flag with different,
right.
With different positions. But, let's not forget that in Santos government, there is something called La Unidad Nacional. There is only one opposition party in Colombia. If there was then one opposition party, there will be a dictatorship. And that's called el Polo Democrático Alternativo. And if we go look anywhere else, no one else has made any debates or any confrontation towards the new government. Only one political party. And that's a very, very, very important thing to understand. Because we're seeing how much is the left being diminished in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this in the media. And about the media information, there is very good information called Contravía. Contravía, I don't know if you heard her about journalist Holman Morris. Holman Morris was appointed by President Uribe as a former FARC member, saying that he used to throw terrorist parties up in the jungle when he was informing the FARC. And this actually ruined his life. But he has this proposal for Latin America to create a Latin American channel with the independent journalist of every Latin American country, paid by the people for the people. So you should look it up.
Great, thank you.
Something else? You were about to say something.
That to, for instance, I don't think, I disagree that Santos is less arrogant than Uribe. He's probably less stupid. He's more pervasive. He's more intelligent. As a matter of fact, right before he became a president, he was interviewed by CNN. And he openly said about Uribe, he said, well, I'm not a peasant. I'm from a wealthy upper class in Colombia. I just not get in Washington a few years ago. I visited Washington since I was a child. So he said it right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I believe that his strategy, his counterinsurgency strategy, is more sophisticated, you know, and more pervasive. Last week, as a matter of fact, through Telemundo, I think, or Univision, there is this series that is called Infiltrados. And they're using the latest documentary filmed by CNN, or CINN,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Colombia, and just openly, sort of, showing the world, especially United States, how they infiltrated the FARC in order to assassinate Reyes, and Mono Jojoy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very psychological warfare that Santos is utilizing. And all these sort of social duties to the Colombian people and the land that is not used, and no, all this is just to take away the water out of the park for the fish to die, which is the FARC and the ELN. So I think that Santos, who was the architect of the counterinsurgency strategy during the Uribe years, for 8 years, right? And whose family, like Eunice said, owned the media,
RCN,
La Semana, right? The massive mediums in Colombia. He's just more pervasive. He's more evil, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just that he is a little bit more diplomatic. He has a little bit more money.
That's what I'm trying to say.
I think the kind of thing kind of happened here in the United States, too. I mean, George Bush and Dick Cheney, certainly they didn't invent war for profit. Certainly they didn't invent torture, empire. You know, they didn't invent this stuff. They made it, like, very obvious, very arrogant. And so I think that the ruling class, what I call the robber class, they identified that they needed somebody a little kinder and gentler. You know, it's like people tell me, well, at least Obama is articulate. At least Obama is smart. At least, you know, I'm not under any mistaken notion that George Bush is stupid either, you know, and so, or that Obama is any, like, genius. So every 4 to 8 years here in the United States, you get this, like, fresh coat of paint slapped on the old dilapidated building, but the infrastructure is still rotten and diseased. But then we get the people who in this country are smart, who should be opposing Obama and his policies, support it. this lady told me last night that she got an email from somebody in North Chicago. And this email said, we have to get the jobs bill passed so we can elect more Democrats. Yeah. How about get the jobs bill passed because nobody has a freaking job? You know? Instead of, oh, so we can elect Democrats. It's just like this terrible cycle we get in that the political system is somehow going to be our, here in the United States, is going to be our savior. You know, when there's never been any evidence. There's rarely been any evidence of that. Against contrary, we have this national amnesia. My friend Gore Vidal calls it the United States of amnesia. You know, we have this amnesia and we forget about the history and everything. So, and I think the globalists, the neoliberals, they know this. They know that the people can be easily manipulated politically.
Yes.
Just to comment on that and tie it in with other things. I don't think we're manipulated easily. I think we face the most sophisticated propaganda machine in history. And just to respond to your comments about NPR and PBS, I think it's extremely important to expose them. They are a creation that is especially for one segment of the population, the educated people. So they appeal to that section by saying, compare us to CNN or whatever, and you'll see how great we are, that we bring out the facts. But if you actually study it compared to looking at broadcasts from other countries, even countries that are not that progressive, even like French TV or German TV, you get some more information that shows how little we get from PBS or any other source. And we have to smash any of these subtle variations of, you know, the same theme as you're talking about with Obama, for example. These are the most dangerous kinds of media because people who might otherwise play a good role are put to sleep by thinking that there is something in the system that is going to at least tell them the truth or more of the truth and so on. And PBS and NPR do occasionally tell the truth, but what they don't tell you and the distortions of what they do tell you are extremely, extremely important forms of brainwashing us. And this is an example of, I don't know what's true in other countries, but I'm sure there's a range of propaganda and manipulation. But I think in our country, we are really the victims of brainwashing. It takes a tremendous effort to pull ourselves out of an education that teaches us that we're a great country and we have a great story, and if only we go back to the Constitution, we'd be okay, and all kinds of things like that. So your experience shows it's not so easy, right?
It was not
so easy. Already were progressive, but it wasn't until you really became active that you really began to research. And isn't that true of all of us? You know, were we born smart? Or, you know, you have to, I mean, the thing that you have to do is asking a lot of people, we have to research ourselves, you know, like you were talking about. That takes a tremendous amount of time. So we have to pull that and create our own sources and our own networks and so on, because there's no other way. This is a tremendous job.
I just wanted to add to that that it's complicated to do that, to shift from the media that you are in love with. And for, in my personal case in Venezuela, I was in love with the mainstream media of Venezuela, El Universal, El Nacional, Unión Radios, Globovisión, RCTV, I mean, all those TV stations and the most important newspapers in Venezuela, I read them all. I was reading newspapers and I was 13 or something like that, trying to imitate my father or something like that. but I read a lot newspapers. And in 2002, and that's why I want to mention this, I mean, the reality, when the reality shakes you, you see things that you didn't see before. And at least that's what happened to me. I mean, I was in front of a TV watching that they were saying that nothing was happening in the Miraflores Palace while I was watching
something happen
out of the street, that there were people in the street asking for the return of Hugo Chavez in 2002. I mean, when you see that, I mean, something, I mean, you really realize that they are lying to you. And that's like a big, strong, like divorce or something like that, that happens because you are like in shock. And I believe that people, I mean, there are different ways to realize that the media most of the time say what they want us to have.
Right, for sure.
So I believe that, I mean, I just want to add to that because I suffer that experience in my own flesh.
Well, just for this recent Libya thing, the scams and the frauds surrounding Libya, it was proven, I think it was the BBC, they showed a photograph of, you know, thousands and thousands of people in this square, and they said it was an anti-Qaddafi rally. It was proven that that it was a rally that happened in India. Yeah, I mean, they think we're so stupid that the people that are looking at it can't recognize Indian writing or the flags and stuff or the geography around it. People are like, hey, that happened in India. and it's just scandalous. It's scandalous what they do.
Cindy, are we able to get your radio show here in Chicago?
You can get my radio show at my website, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. And it's cindysheehansoapbox.com. And I started it in January of 2009. And we have about 110 shows right now that are all at the archives. So you have 110, so that's like 55 hours of awesome, great radio shows that you can, if you have never heard my show, now you can go home and listen to them. And then I have a blog, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox Blogspot, because I do often write, and I just posted an article today about the Cuban Five, and you know, Iran, you talked about the hikers in Iran. They released the hikers. It was, you know, President Chavez had something to do with that. And I just found out I had something to do with him having something to do with that. Mm-hmm. I wrote a letter to him requesting that he intervene on behalf of the hikers. And also I intervened on behalf of the hikers too. However, so Iran, another evil thing, right? They showed mercy to the hikers who were convicted. I really don't believe that they were guilty. You know, I always question things like that. Well, were they spies, this or that or whatever? I know I've gotten to know their families well. Their statements when they came out were wonderful. It's like, we're still recognize that the U.S. is torturing people in Guantanamo and things like that. They talked about political prisoners too. And so anyway, I wrote that. And if Iran could show mercy, then why can't the United States show mercy and release the Cuban Five? And so that's my latest article. If people want to go to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox Blogspot and read that, it's called Show a Little Mercy. And then, I write a lot and stuff. That's just, and I'm so articulate too. But don't forget, I have this email list and I have books if people want
yes,
to get them.
Give a round of applause to Cindy. And I want to thank too for being here and for all your questions, which were very interesting.
Could I just add one thing?
Yes.
Cindy is here. I think we have a political opening in the election.